This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Jim Bertel. AFP reports a river of boiling lava in the Democratic Republic of Congo came to a halt on the outskirts of Goma Sunday after the nighttime volcanic eruption sent thousands of terrified residents fleeing in panic. Thousands had fled during the night, and many families slept on pavements surrounded by their belongings under a night sky turned red by fire and fumes. Chinese state media says 21 people have died while running a mountain cross-country ultra-marathon in the country's northwest after hail, freezing rain, and gale-force winds hit the high-altitude race. One runner who quit the race said other runners weren't dressed for winter-like conditions, many wearing short-sleeved tops. A woman who worked for the race organizers said there were no predictions of extreme weather for the day of the race. However, the local branch of the National Early Warning Information Center warned for the past 3 days of hail and strong winds. Iran's parliament speaker says international inspectors may no longer access surveillance images of the Islamic Republic's nuclear sites, escalating tensions amid diplomatic efforts in Vienna to save Tehran's atomic accord with world powers. The comments aired by state TV further underscored the narrowing window for the U.S. and others to reach terms with Iran. The Islamic Republic is already enriching and stockpiling uranium at levels far beyond those allowed by the 2015 nuclear deal. Iran media reports the country has started rolling blackouts, which officials blamed on heat, drought impacting hydropower generation, and surging electricity demand blamed in part on cryptocurrency mining. For more information on any of today's news, please go to voanews.com. This is VOA News. The United States says it will expand Haitian eligibility for a humanitarian program that grants deportation relief and work permits to immigrants who cannot safely return to their home countries. The plan will cover an estimated 150,000 Haitians already living in the United States. Democrats and pro-immigrant advocates had pressed the Biden administration to make more Haitians living in the country illegally eligible for deportation relief. Italian emergency services say 9 people were killed and 2 children seriously injured Sunday after a cable car plunged into the side of a mountain in northern Italy. The Ministry of Infrastructure says the accident occurred around 10:30 UTC as the car was about 100 meters from the summit. British health officials say a double dose of COVID-19 vaccines is almost as effective against the fast-spreading variant of the coronavirus, first identified in India, as it is against Britain's dominant strain. Britain's health ministry says the information is groundbreaking and is increasingly hopeful that the government will be able to lift more COVID restrictions next month. New coronavirus cases in the U.S. have decreased to rates not seen since June. AP's Ben Thomas reports.
The decrease in new coronavirus cases is sparking optimism that vaccination campaigns are stemming both severe COVID-19 cases and the spread of the virus. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky says the 7-day average has dropped below 30,000 cases per day.
The last time the 7-day average of cases per day was this low was June 18, 2020.
The average number of deaths over the last 7 days has also dropped to 552, a rate not seen since July. Health experts credit the rollout of vaccines for the dramatic turnaround. The CDC says more than 60% of people over 18 have received at least one shot, and almost half are fully vaccinated, though they note that's not enough to completely extinguish the virus. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Gordon Bashir, the BBC journalist who tricked Princess Diana into giving an explosive interview, is apologizing to Princes William and Harry, but says claims linking his actions to her death were, quote, unreasonable. A report published on Thursday found that Bashir commissioned fake bank statements that falsely suggested some of Diana's closest aides were being paid by the security services to keep tabs on her. Prince William says Bashir's actions and the interview had made a major contribution to the demise of his parents' relationship and contributed significantly to his mother's fear, paranoia, and isolation in her final years. Via remote, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impulga.
His death came at a time the country is grappling with so much state of insecurity. Every part of the country is facing one form of insecurity or the other. Majority of his focus has been towards the Northeast, try to reinvigorate the fight against terrorism.
Nigerians react to the sudden death of the country's military chief and other officials who were killed in a plane crash Friday in central Kaduna state.
Illnesses, for example, like depression in African cultures are not recognized as mental illnesses. So I think there's a need for people to understand that. I mean, if you see a relative, for example, talking of suicide, don't take it lightly. I mean, the person probably is already entertaining those ideas.
Psychologists say the COVID pandemic has increased the number of attempted suicides among refugees in Uganda.
He says hospital treatment is still out of reach for millions of poor Cameroonians, despite government promises to reduce costs by giving subventions to the poor.
And several dozen patients at Cameroon government-run hospitals who could not afford to pay for their treatment are allowed to leave after being held for several months. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigerians are reacting to the sudden death of the country's military chief, Ibrahim Atahiru, and other officials who were killed in a plane crash Friday in central Kaduna state. Atahiru was appointed early this year to lead the army's fight against Nigeria's decade-long insurgency. Timothy Abiezu reports from Abuja.
The military Beechcraft 350 aircraft was carrying the military chief on official duty in Kaduna State Friday evening when it lost control and crashed near Kaduna International Airport. 10 others, including the high-ranking military intelligence chief, provost marshal, and crew members, were also on board. No one survived. The army says the officers will be buried Saturday at the military cemetery in Abuja. It's the first time a serving military chief died while on active duty. Many Nigerians have reacted to the incident. President Muhammadu Buhari tweeted, quote, "All of them are heroes who paid the ultimate price for peace and security in the land," end quote. Abuja resident Enimobong Edoho is still in disbelief.
"I feel terrible opening my phone to see the news of the chief of army staff was rather devastating."
Authorities believe the aircraft crashed as a result of bad weather. The 54-year-old Atahiru was appointed as military chief in late January after President Buhari retired the then-serving chief over growing security concerns. Security analyst Senator Iribu says his death is a huge strike to the counterinsurgency effort he was leading.
"His death came at a time the country is grappling with so much state of insecurity. Every part of the country is facing one form of insecurity or the other. Majority of his focus has been towards the Northeast, try to reinvigorate the fight against terrorism."
However, Iribu says a new chief must be appointed without delay.
"The Nigerian army cannot operate without a head. There's a big vacuum. If care is not taken, the enemies may take advantage of this."
At least 17 military officers have died in plane crashes in the last 3 months. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Uganda hosts Africa's biggest chunk of refugees who fled war and starvation, and psychologists say the rate of attempted suicides among them has jumped during the COVID pandemic. Reporter Halima Athman looks at efforts to help those who fled physical danger only to suffer from deadly mental trauma.
I don't want you to think about negative ways of...
22-year-old Meta Justin from the Democratic Republic of Congo was already living a hard life in one of Uganda's refugee settlements. When the Ugandan government announced measures last year to control the spread of COVID-19, life got even harder. With little or no work available to locals, Meta, who previously survived on casual labor outside the settlement, had no income to supplement the aid his family was given. For Meta, who lived with five siblings and a jobless father, it was the hunger that almost got him to take his life.
We slept 2 days without eating food. We're just surviving on just porridge, bit of porridge which sustained us for the bit of moments. And then I was like, if it's like this, which means it's useless for me to stay in this world.
Mamuru Jackson, a refugee from South Sudan, says it was the lack of human interaction that pushed him to the brink. Having fled to Uganda with a younger brother, leaving his mother and father in South Sudan, Mamuru wasn't ready to assume the role of a parent.
Actually, that thought came to my mind.
Why?
Because I feel like I'm alone in this world. And also the work at the home, because I was the only elder person, the other brother of mine is still very young, I feel overwhelmed.
Malay Ali, a psychologist and counsellor, says both Justin's and Jackson's conditions would depend due to the thought of not being cared for after separation from family. He outlines the underlying issues.
Parental abuse, poverty, those who have been stricken, then those who are traumatized, especially those who faced violence, exchange of bullets. Now, like for the refugee dwellers, that they really had a lot of post-traumatic stress that was now transitioning them to another stage of contemplating suicide.
Psychologists say the contemplation of suicide takes place in stages. These include losing hope, planning on how to end their lives by either using an overdose, poison, ropes, or falling from high elevations, and finally accomplishing the act. It is at the second stage that psychologists say people at risk must get the attention they need to prevent them going through with suicide. Professor Eugene Kanyinda is a member of the Medical Research Council Unit of Uganda.
Illnesses, for example, like depression, in African cultures are not recognized as mental illnesses. So I think there's a need for people to understand that. I mean, if you see a relative, for example, talking of suicide, don't take it lightly. I mean, the person probably is already entertaining those ideas.
Some warning signs psychiatrists say one should look out for are withdrawal, crying, self-isolation, loss of interest in formerly pleasurable activities, and lack of sleep. For survivors of suicide attempts, counselors refer them as heroes to encourage them to think positively.
Like hope is gone, look inside you and be strong.
Halima Mani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
This past week, the United Nations Children Fund, UNICEF, the World Health Organization, WHO, and the Global Partnership for Education convened a two-day virtual dialogue with ministers of health and education from 22 African countries. Together, they deliberated on how to keep schools in southern and eastern Africa safely opened amid the COVID-19 pandemic. The discussions allowed participating countries to share the latest knowledge and best practices, as well as put in place action plans needed to open schools and keep students and teachers safe. Mavis Ochere has more from Jauso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
When COVID-19 began to spread in March of 2020, 127 million pre-primary and secondary school children in Eastern and Southern Africa were left out of school for months, and in some countries over a year, they joined another 37 million students who already were not attending school before the pandemic. By the beginning of 2021, countries in the region had reopened schools either partially or fully. Licky van der Wiel is UNICEF's Deputy Regional Director for Eastern and Southern Africa. She says officials from the region's ministries of health and education, who participated in the virtual discussion, shared their efforts to keep schools open and safe. She says most countries had officials from both ministries present, and quite a number of countries had additional ministries or authorities participating to ensure that the commitment was government-wide.
The meeting was really a moment to get to know each other, to kickstart consistent dialogues and action plans, to jointly formulate an action plan, while for the others, it was more to see what was out there, to reassess their own plans, to quality proof whatever they had formulated before, and then, of course, adjust to the new realities, but also to the learning from other countries.
Vanderwill says, for example, in Kenya, priorities have been set to include how to systemize monitoring and surveillance. Authorities will work to report cases that are appearing in schools and ensure the strategies for reopening are consistent across Eastern and Southern Africa. She says Madagascar's priorities are slightly different from its neighbor. Health and education officials there are creating an interministerial technical group to ensure that decision-making is inclusive and evidence-based. Vanderwill says that effective school reopening takes place when there is robust coordination of policy and decision-making. Together, they promote the effective monitoring and management of COVID-19 transmission within schools, along with measures to prevent and mitigate the disease.
In Namibia, schools have an integrated school health task force now, and that has a wide representation from across the community, which discuss those issues on a regular basis and transparently.
She says more than a year after the declaration of COVID-19 pandemic, there is a better understanding of the role played by children and schools in the transmission of coronavirus. She says evidence shows that children are at low risk of contracting and transmitting the disease, and therefore schools are not a place of greater transmission at all.
For example, in 2020, all COVID cases reported by the countries, only 8% were children and adolescents affected by the COVID. But don't forget that the global population of these children and adolescents are 29%. So in fact, you can really see that children are at much less risk of getting COVID and transmitting therefore COVID. Also, when it comes to the deaths, unfortunate deaths affected by COVID, only 0.2% were reported to be children or people under the age of 20.
Vanderwill says Somalia and Uganda have not yet opened all their schools. In Botswana, schools are expected to be open next week, though there are multiple and complex reasons for only partially reopening some of them. The UNICEF official says a result of the dialogue, ministries of health and education are expected to make sure the physical and mental health needs of children are included in the effort to bring students back to school and enhance their learning opportunities. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Jaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
Cameroonian officials say several dozen patients at government-run hospitals who could not afford to pay for their treatment have been allowed to leave after being held for several months. The patients and their family members protested last week in the capital, Yaounde, blocking some sick people from entering healthcare facilities. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaounde.
Rosalie Dipoko is a 43-year-old farmer and single mother of three children. She says she has been prohibited from leaving the government's central hospital in Cameroon's capital, Yaounde, since March 25. She was involved in a fatal road accident in Bafia on the outskirts of Yaounde in December 2020. Her leg has been amputated. Dipoko says she is tired of what she calls the physical and mental torture of being held against her will because she lacks $1,000 to settle her hospital bill.
Si l'État a transformé les hôpitaux en centre de détention, ils doivent nous le faire.
She says it is very unhealthy for a hospital to prohibit poor people who cannot pay bills from returning to their homes. She says people visit hospitals to find relief, not to be tortured psychologically for the simple reason that they are poor and cannot afford to settle hospital bills. She says guards forcefully stopped hungry patients from going out of hospital gates to look for food, and that poor patients bathe in open spaces in front of passers-by. This week, DIPOCO and scores of patients and their family members held protests at government-run hospitals. They blame the government for not being able to take care of poor patients and called on officials to settle their bills and grant them freedom to return to their houses. Some of the patients forced their way out of hospitals. Others prohibited the sick from accessing medical staff as part of their demonstration. Police said it protected civilians visiting hospitals for treatment and made no arrest. Manauda Malashi, Cameroon's health minister, visited the central hospital on Friday.
Nous avons, pour ceux qui ne pouvaient vraiment pas payer, on a demandé à l'hôpital de faire les formalités pour les libérer et nous verrons comment.
Malashi says he asked hospital officials to allow poor patients who cannot afford to pay bills after treatment to return to their homes with exceptions. He says the Ministry of Health will draw from its limited emergency budget to settle unpaid bills. Malashi says if Cameroonians fail to pay hospital bills, claiming that they are poor, hospitals will not be able to offer treatment to the sick when they run short of funds to buy equipment and medication. He says well-to-do family members should, in solidarity, help sick relatives pay their bills. Cameroon's National Institute of Statistics reports that 80% of the Central African states 25 million people do not have health insurance. When they fall sick, they rely on their savings, family members, and well-wishers to settle hospital bills. A study by the Institute indicates that in 2019, 70% of the country's total health expenditure was borne by households. Danelle Bikolke is spokesperson of the Cameroon Association for Equal Access to Treatment. He says Cameroon needs to improve access to health care for the poor. He says 70% of Cameroonians prefer visiting African traditional healers for treatment because health care is very expensive at conventional hospitals.
C'est le ministre de la Santé qui avait parlé d'abord de ça.
He says hospital treatment is still out of reach for millions of poor Cameroonians, despite government promises to reduce costs by giving subventions to the poor. He says the government cannot rely on families to settle hospital bills of their sick relatives because nothing compels relatives to help. He says only a well-developed health policy can help poor patients. Cameroon's Minister of Health reports that many patients visit hospitals only when their situations have become critical. Hospitals treat them with the hope of having bills settled after treatment. Some patients started escaping after treatment, and hospitals began prohibiting them from leaving until bills are settled. Malashi said Cameroon since August 2020 has been providing its universal health coverage plan, which will make it possible for the poor to pay less for treatment. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
At a global health summit held in Rome, leaders of the G20 made a commitment to speed up the end of the COVID-19 pandemic. The announcement was made as pharmaceutical companies pledged to increase their delivery of desperately needed COVID-19 vaccines to low-income countries. Sabina Castafranco reports from Rome.
Leaders of the world's 20 advanced economies, or the G20, attended a global health summit in Rome with the aim of finding solutions for the COVID-19 pandemic and in preparation of future global health challenges. A first of its kind, the International Forum brought together countries with cumulative economies accounting for over 8% of the world's GDP. Pharmaceutical companies made pledges to supply COVID-19 vaccines to low and medium income countries. The host of the summit, Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi, called those contributions significant and staggering. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the pledges made during the summit send a strong message.
BioNTech, Pfizer, they committed to deliver 1 billion doses this year at non-profit for low-income countries and lower costs for middle-income countries. I think this is a very clear public statement. The same goes for 200 million this year from Johnson & Johnson and 100 million this year from Moderna.
By the end of the year, von der Leyen said, Team Europe has also pledged 100 million doses, and she stressed her certainty that the pledges would be honoured. Unveiled Friday, the EU-funded Team Europe is an initiative focused on manufacturing and access to vaccines, medicine and health technology in Africa. The summit participants, world leaders and representatives of pharmaceutical companies signed a Rome Declaration with a list of 16 principles that underscore the importance of open supply chains and equitable access to tools to combat vaccination imbalances.
I think it is groundbreaking and really historical because you have for the very first time the G20. That is the United States and China, the European Union and Russia, India and Latin America, South Africa and many others, all of them committing to basic principles.
Von der Leyen explained the importance of the Rome Declaration. Von der Leyen said what emerged during the summit was a very clear no to health nationalism, meaning countries producing vaccines should not keep them for themselves, but make them available to those who are not yet able to manufacture their own. According to the World Health Organization, just 2% of the population in Africa has been vaccinated. Von der Leyen said the continent is importing 99% of vaccines, and she stressed that that must change. She also said that Europe will be making available $1.2 billion for an initiative that it plans to launch with African partners to develop vaccine production in Africa through regional hubs on the continent. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Somalia this year was hit by a double punch, a second wave of coronavirus, and political turmoil over elections that threatened to spark armed conflict. However, while political tensions cooled, the impact on the economy continues, as Mohamed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu.
Somalia is recovering from the threat of civil war when troops in April took sides overholding elections and a controversial term extension for those in power that was later dropped. Over 100,000 Mogadishu residents who had sought refuge outside the capital have been returning to their homes. But Somali analysts say the impact is still being felt economically.
When there is a fear of looming clashes, prices of goods escalate, and people save their few resources for future consumption. Many banks in Mogadishu experienced massive withdrawals, and many more fled the city, seeking shelter on safer places.
The political tension is added to the economic woes from the coronavirus pandemic. A second wave of infections is swept through Somalia from February, doubling confirmed cases and spiking official deaths by 48%. Somalia's tour and travel agencies are among the businesses most affected.
All travel agencies have laid off staff, and their families were dependent on them. The COVID-19 pandemic has severely affected travel agencies at large. Our agency was badly impacted, including income and operation. This led to redundancies and loss of livelihoods for many workers.
Somalia's hoteliers are also suffering.
This hotel's lifeline is dependent on both foreign and local visitors. 100% of our foreign clients have stopped coming, while the number of local visitors drastically.
Sponty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is Prince Nestor broadcasting from Washington. Welcome to VOA Africa's special coverage of the inaugural Basketball African League taking place in Rwanda. Tunisian giants U.S. Monastir ended their group campaign Saturday with a perfect record after beating the host team, Patriots of Rwanda 91-75, with Rwandan President Paul Kagame in the stands. Lebanese guard Wael Araghchi scored a game-high 28 points for Monastir and again earned comparisons to former Argentine great Manu Ginobili with his shooting style and dazzling moves to the basket. Sarah Chan, the manager of Africa Scouting for the 2019 NBA champion Toronto Raptors, also attended the game in Kigali. I asked her about the mood at the Kigali Arena, the performance of each team, and her career as a basketball player in Africa and in the United States.
My name is Sarah Chan. I'm the manager of African Scouting for the Toronto Raptors. Played a little bit, coached a little bit, and here I am scouting.
Briefly, just a little bit about your background. Your history is important to our listeners.
So I'm from South Sudan. I grew up in Khartoum until I was about 12, and South Sudan was going through a civil war. It's a 21-year-old civil war that had affected everybody, and so my family and I relocated to Kenya, looking for greener pastures, looking for peace, putting education at the center of everything. I remember that's the one thing I don't even know when I never heard those emphases. Like, my parents always reiterated, we go, we learn, we come back, and we impact. That was the song in our daily lives. And so a background of civil war into being privileged to have an amazing family that's very supportive of a young girl that was trying something out, a dreamer, and a family that is, you know, right behind you, pushing you and encouraging you to, you know, pursue your passion, your goals, and gave you perspective and grounded you in that it's not about you. It's about using your gifts to impact yourself, but to also impact those around you and to bring glory to God.
What inspired you, you know, to start your basketball career?
I started my basketball career in Kenya, in high school. I was actually forced into it because I was one of the tallest kids around. And I followed rules and I said, okay, I don't know where this is going, but you know what? I'm going to stay healthy anyway. And this is how I started off. And started falling in love with the game. And my coach was just so amazing. And I had incredible teammates. And so it just made it really fun to do. And it became my heaven, my safe haven. So started in Kenya, ended up getting scholarships out of it, played a pro for a little bit, and came back home. And, you know, so I managed the African scouting for the Toronto Raptors.
What does it entail?
So scouting is basically, we're talent seekers, for lack of a better word, across Africa. And we have an amazing network of scouts from the Raptors. And so it is coordinating all of that and also scouting, like basically looking for, you know, the prospects, the NBA prospects, suggesting. And for me, you know, it's personal because I know what sports have done for me personally. So for me, it's anybody that I feel can have an opportunity at whatever level. And if I have contacts, I always connect, you know. If it's a kid and I'm like, I think this kid is, you know, it might not be going to an NCAA school, but can go to an NAIA or a JUCO. For me, it's beyond the game. It's the using it as a tool to empower the kids, you get an education out of it. The outcome doesn't have to be like Pascal Siakam's, but, you know, you go somewhere and you do something for yourself. So, yeah.
Are you in the stadium, you know, when the match between the Patriots against U.S. Monastir was taking place? Could you please tell us, for those of us who weren't in the stadium, what was the mood like? How was the match?
God, oh my God. It is one of the most exciting games this far. The environment was just so electric. The energy was so high. And for a second there, I look around and I'm like, this is the NBA. This is like me sitting in Scotia Arena. And the level of the game that is going on that I'm watching, I'm looking at them and I'm like, wow, the intensity. Like, I'm feeling it myself. I'm right there with this. It's crazy. The intensity of the game was amazing. They were running the floor, great shot selections. The ball movement was just incredible. And the leadership on the floor, the future is so bright for this tournament. And this game was such an exemplary game for this. The entire week, I haven't watched a game like this one. You know, the team effort from both teams, the sportsmanship, the officiation of the officiating of the game. They executed the plays with such, it was a beauty to watch how they executed the plays, how they were working with their teammates, how they were putting each other in positions that were, you know, getting their teammates great shots, the passes. Yo, it was just beautiful. It captivated me. And I said, this game was the best game so far.
And so, and you know, taking off of, you know, what you just say, this game was the best so far. Do you expect these two teams maybe to be in the finals of the tournament? And maybe tying into that, what so far some of the standout teams in this tournament for you?
The standout teams in this tournament would be the one we just watched, the Tunisian team. Patriots have also showed a great deal. We've also watched Zamalek from Egypt. They've done so well. And so I'm predicting at least one or two of those will be in the final.
What does this tournament mean for the African continent? You were in the stadium. You were watching this particular match. The president of Rwanda actually attended the match, you know, with the first family.
It's progressive leadership that, you know, makes the world move around and advances tournaments like this. Because without him, the NBA, FIBA, we don't have the arena. Let's start there. So there's not, you know, the actual structure. And then you come down to the leadership within the NBA, the people that work behind the scenes to bring this tournament here and to make it a success and execute with such diligence. And then the opportunities this is going to have, the ripple effects of just what the BAL stands for, impacting the next generation of athletes. There were 15 NBA scouts and team representatives watching this tournament. And this gives us an opportunity to look at young prospects early and build a file. And this is more opportunity for the players. This is job creation for the people. This is economic, it's a social economic benefit to all of Africa, right? And so the world will continue to reap the fruits of this tournament because it's also a pipeline to the NBA, right? And it's our prayer that it keeps growing and, you know, it already has the sustainability aspects of things. So it will keep growing and we hope that it gets to the point where interchangeably athletes can go from the NBA to the BAL or from the BAL to the NBA. You know, so it is such a moment that makes you proud to be African. You look down and you see women leadership on the floor, the referees, the DJ Ivy from the Mavericks, right? You have Yolam, you have Usher, you have Michelle from BBC. And these are young women doing things, phenomenal sisters doing amazing things, right? And so the opportunities within this are limitless.
Absolutely. And I love the passion, you know, that you bring to it, because looks like this is something that is really touching your heart, you know. And what does basketball mean to you?
Man, basketball is life. It becomes a lifestyle. It becomes the reason I wake up. It is my purpose. And it reminds me of the saying, the quote by Mandela, sports has the power to change the world. It has the power to inspire. It has the power to unite. And it has the power to create hope. And I look at this, and this is hope. This is a platform, an elite platform, for players to showcase what they have, and for the world, you know, to basically enjoy the fruits of talent, because Africa is spoiled for choices. We have such an immense pool of talent, and now there's a platform where they can exhibit what they have. And so it's a gift to the world, and it's also a gift to us. So basketball is life. Basketball is peace. Basketball is opportunities. Basketball is unity, and the power of it to transcend boundaries. I call it home. You know, when you go home, yeah, that place, basketball is home.
Oh, my. Beautiful, fantastic stuff. And I like the way you say it, since the world hasn't seen anything yet. The world hasn't seen Sarah yet. Yet. Any surprises so far as far as the tournament is concerned?
The only surprise for me is the Nigeria team's performance. I expected a bit much more from them, you know. I've also, in the best way possible, not really surprised, but I'm glad that the Patriots from Rwanda, the host, are playing at a high and intense competitive way. It's they didn't come to play. Like, you know, it's not a game. They are taking this very serious. They're intentional. You can see that they have been working in the way that they've been playing. The chemistry of the team, you know, just the discipline of the players, everything is showing. And that's why they're playing how they're playing. And tonight's game would have gone either way. It was not for the turnovers that they had in the first half, and, you know, not converting some of those breakaways, not making their free throw shots, which were very crucial for a game like this, you know. So, yeah, you know, other than the disappointments, there's also this beautiful surprises of this different team stepping up, and leadership and experience just showing out tonight, you know.
Mm. Yeah. You also come from South Sudan. What does this tournament mean for South Sudan and Africa? You know, what should we take from this moving forward to the future?
Elevation and progress come from leadership, and we must hold each other accountable. We must take sports more serious and invest in the youth and continue to give accessibility and look at the opportunities within this. This is a nation that went through tragedy. Look at how they healed and, you know, how they made a comeback, you know, and how they're now bringing the world together. They're uniting all of us. It's incredible. It's an amazing time. And I hope people's eyes are open and their hearts are receptive to seeing what is being displayed and to wanting to duplicate a Kigali Arena in, you know, in South Sudan, a Kigali Arena, you know, like a Kigali Arena standard in Ghana, in, you know, all the rest of the countries. It's my hope that, you know, the rest of Africa, you know, we have a 2 or 3 type of Kigali standard classic stadium in every country, in all 3 major, you know, major cities of different countries, that if we had that, can you imagine just what that presents in terms of, you know, job opportunities, in terms of accessibilities, in terms of elevating the game. So it's my hope that we all take a leaf from this and only get better from here.
That's Sarah Chan, the manager of Africa Scouting for the NBA's Toronto Raptors team, speaking with me from Kigali about the Basketball African League tournament in Rwanda. Ending other games played on Saturday, Mozambique champions Ferroviário de Maputo advanced to the quarterfinals after beating Algeria's GS Petroliers 86-73. Congolese Canadian Mike Kabongo led Maputo with 18 points. Teammates Ajay Barrow of Ivory Coast and Alvaro Massa tallied 17 points each. Meanwhile, American Taryn Sullivan scored 19 points to help Nigerian champions Rivers Hoopers secure their first win of the tournament and boost their hopes of qualifying to the next stage after dispatching Madagascar's GNBC 80-69 in the last group game. I'm Prince Nesta, and you're listening to special VOA Africa coverage of the Basketball African League in Rwanda. Fans, reporters and players across East Africa are applauding the inaugural Basketball Africa League tournament and say it will go far to attract millions of African boys and girls to the sport. Mugume Davis Wakirinji tells us more from Kampala, Uganda.
Basketball fan Albert Ahabwe says he's literally glued on his TV set so as not to miss a game since Basketball Africa League or BAL kicked off at the magnificent Kigali Arena in the Rwandan capital Kigali on Sunday.
What has impressed me is the resourcefulness, the facilities, the general feel of the tournament. It speaks of a professional, high-level organization. Some of the things are a proper NBA touch. The things that they put in the players' rooms, the equipment, the practice courts, the everything, the general logistics of the whole thing are not something Africa is used to.
Rwandan reporter Gakuba Felix Abdujabal, common known as Romario, agrees.
The level of the competition is really very high and very impressive. So I can say that we are actually enjoying the tournament itself because we've seen very good talented players, very young talented players, particularly in the Rwandan team, Patriot, which is representing the country. We have seen a lot of very good players that really have potential. And more importantly, I can say that the bar will be very important for East Africa in particular and Africa in general, as it has really exposed a lot of talents that people really didn't know.
The competition was to have begun last year but was put off in March 2020 because of the coronavirus pandemic. 12 teams across Africa are participating at the inaugural tournament, including host Patriots, who opened the tournament by beating Nigeria's River Hoopers 83-60, the excitement of local fans. Dini Karemela is a sports analyst in Rwanda.
I'm impressed by three things, basically. Number one, it is the ability for these people to pull off this tournament. And by doing that, they are showing the country's determination to change livelihoods and encourage partnerships that will, you know, grow Rwanda's economy sustainably over the foreseeable future. So for the country, that is a very big win. And number two, we've seen social media go crazy. And Rwanda, yes, Rwanda is out there. It is visit Rwanda everywhere. But also it is an opportunity for us to export Rwanda's promising talents to professional leagues across the world.
Lizzie Akumu, who was recently summoned for the Kenya national basketball team, says he's learning a lot from the tournament.
The teams at BAL are top teams from different African countries, and this will help especially players to be appreciated and learn great deals, or rather opportunities, both in Africa and outside Africa. There is healthy competition from the teams, and like I said, BAL is a big platform, and just like every other competition, players are bringing out super competitive talents in them. And personally, watching BAL motivates a lot. Seeing players pushing themselves, making things work strategically to the last whistle is exciting, and I get to learn a lot too as a player.
Ugandan team captain Jimmy Enabu says to now be every basketball player's dream to feature at BAL.
This is where we want to play. So every year you compete in your local league, and hope to emerge as a champion, because you know that there is something higher. So looking at the BAL, this is very motivational for me, motivational for my teammates, because you always feel like there is always a level higher than the one that you're playing that you can push yourself to compete at.
Tanzania sports analyst Nasir Nchimbi also says he's greatly impressed by the BAL tournament and believes it came at the right time to excite fans after many days of horrifying COVID-19 pandemic.
For most Africans, it has been like a surprise. But for those who have been the major part of the process are not surprised with the process, because the president of African Basket Association has been working hard to bring this game here into Africa. Kudos to the president of African Basket Association, Mr. Amadou Fall, together with the NBA commissioner, Mr. Adam Silver, for bringing the game here in Africa, because a lot of Africans have been dreaming of the game. How do they dream? By going abroad so that they can fulfill their dream. But right now, they have to fulfill their dream out here in Africa, since the game and the ball is on their court.
I am Mugume. Davis Rwakarinji ni Kampala, Uganda.
Thanks, Mugume. I'm Prince Nesta, and you're listening to special VOA Africa coverage of the Basketball African League in Rwanda. This past week, our VOA listeners have had our on-air analysis and commentary about the new league. My co-host is basketball buddy and super producer Mugbili Abaro, who shared his thoughts on the inaugural competition.
My thoughts on the matches are that it's been going extremely, extremely well, not only for the continent, but, you know, just everything in general that's been associated with the league so far. I'm loving the African talent that I'm seeing, alongside the international talent as well. Yeah, it's been really exciting to call these games, you know, alongside you. You know how we were jumping in every quarter, halftimes and post games. It's really, really exciting basketball, high quality basketball as well. So, yeah, I think this tournament is just the beginning for Africa.
Any standout performances so far in terms of teams, in terms of individual players?
Man, there's a ton. I feel like Petro de Luanda is a team that's playing really well. The host nation, the Patriots, are one of the fan favorites, you know. The U.S. Monastir team, which is the Tunisian side, is also playing extremely well. Zamalek had a dominating first performance as well. Unfortunately for them, they had their second game canceled. As for the players, I would say from the AS Sally side, Stogland and Rashad are both playing really well. From the U.S. Montessori side, Slimani, Maghreb, and Whale RG Key, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, and, you know, I have to go with, you know, on the Patriots side, I have to say J. Cole, you know, just him being one of my, you know, you know, we gotta give a shout out to my man Cole, just off the simple fact that, you know, he just dropped a phenomenal, you know, body of work, you know, off season. And yeah, a lot of the stuff that he does doesn't necessarily show up on the box score, but he has a lot of intangibles. He's playing well. His team, from a collective standpoint, is playing excellent.
How has the experience broadcasting been like in this tournament so far?
Man, how could it not be super exciting? You know, high-class basketball, going back and forth with you the entire time. We've had the luxury of having amazing guests on, whether it be for halftime or post-games as well. And yeah, all in all, the competition has been elite. We've had teams that, you know, may not perform amazing in their first games, and they come right back as if, you know, as if they didn't even miss a step, you know, like GNBC, for example. They lost by 47, I think, the first game, and they came right back and almost beat the undefeated Patriots, the hosting team. So yeah, it's been unreal, really. Like, and I just cannot wait till we get to the knockout phases, which will reminds me a bit about, you know, reminds me of March Madness, you know. So it's gonna be May Madness for sure.
Oh, I love the sound of that. May Madness, goodness me. You know, and talking about May Madness, in terms of the future, Mukbil, what does the future of African basketball look like in your opinion?
In my opinion, it's so bright. You know, it has endless opportunity. It has endless potential, really. You know, just with the NBA highlighting this one tournament, this being the inaugural one, I don't believe that this is going to be the only one. The NBA has already known about the challenge, the individual plays of African talent. You know, there's been so many African players to have played in college Division I's all over the nation and the NBA level. You know, we have Joel Embiid, this year MVP candidate, right? So they know about the talent that is on the continent, hence why they're starting this at the moment. But I think this will be something that'll take the African game to the next level and maybe even entice other players from other parts of the world to come and want to play in a high class league. And it won't necessarily be, let's only go and play for the European leagues if we're unable to make it to the NBA. Why not come to Africa, you know?
Interesting. I love that analysis, Mukbil. Always, always on top of your game when it comes to analysis. What do you think African players need to do in order to dominate world basketball?
And, you know, with African players, a lot of times they don't necessarily have the facilities, you know, that some of these other players in other parts of the world might have. But with this help, I feel as though, you know, with the spotlight, a lot of different countries will take the initiative to start setting up more facilities for young players to develop themselves. But I definitely see that there's endless possibility for the game in the continent. I'm super excited to even be a part of this inaugural tournament. Really, really, I'm excited.
That's my basketball buddy and super producer Mukbilia Baro, my co-host during VOA Africa special live coverage of the Basketball Africa League. One of the African basketball coaches supporting the new BAL League in Rwanda is Peter Ahmedi, the assistant coach of Nigeria's national women's team. In an interview with Ion Mike Mbonye, Coach Ahmedi says he's grateful to see the Basketball African League come to fruition.
Yes, on the issue of VAR, great initiative, great idea, and a great step. We believe that before now, at least such idea would have been initiated, but there's always a saying that says it's never late than never. So we thank God for FIBA Africa, we thank God for NBA Africa for this great initiative. Today, BAL Basketball Africa League has started, and we know that it was started earlier before pandemic and COVID-19 that has shut the whole world down, and a lot of competition and a lot of programming, a lot of traveling was restricted because of the COVID-19. So, great idea, great one there, I will still tell you.
Some basketball analysts, coaches, and officials have argued that the number of teams for the Basketball Africa League should be increased. What's your take?
For the number of teams that are taking part presently in BAL, in a large continent like Africa, I still believe it's not enough, and they should be able to expand it, because if you look at the method of picking, six teams went for elimination, qualifies, and give their very best. But the other six country were picked, which I remember Nigerian Real Hooper was one of the teams that were picked. And the question I ask most times, what happened to the second team? Sometimes you might be surprised that the second teams might be better than even the first in terms of organization, in terms of playing. But winning the championship does not make you a better team at that year until you prove it once or twice, which I tell you FIBA Africa should look into it and be able to create another avenue, another pool, another competition for the second team that will not be left out. Because if it's only first affair, then that means that you might not get the best team, the best player in terms of playing basketball in Africa. I'm also urging them.
Do you think that in future, the organizers and sponsors of the Basketball Africa League should create a new league for women basketball clubs in the continent?
I'm also urging FIBA Africa, NBA Africa, to be able to extend the league to the female side. And with the kind of abundance of talent we have in Africa, I'm sure when that is done, the world will have a pool to look into it. I take you back to the NBA draft this year, you could remember Ole in Nigeria. You have 9 players who were only drafted from Nigeria. And with such opportunity now, I'm sure the world will have a lot and a lot of opportunity, a lot of pool to look into in Africa. So I want to thank FIBA Africa for a great job well done. I want to thank NBA Africa and especially to our Voice of America for promoting the game of basketball. Thank you.
And that wraps up our May 23rd pregame show. Thanks to the National Basketball Association, NBA, the International Basketball Federation, FIBA, and the Voice of America for making this broadcast possible. Special thanks to my halftime and postgame co-host, super producer Mokbili Abaru. And thank you for tuning in. I'm Prince Nesta on VOA Africa's Basketball Africa League pregame show. Those VOA Africa special coverage of the historical NBA Basketball African League Championship games in Rwanda.